And now it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the session and to welcome Dr. Troy Torgerson. He is an associate professor of pediatric immunology and rheumatology at the University of Washington School of Medicine and at Seattle Children's Hospital. He is the director of the Immunology Diagnostic Lab at Seattle Children's Research Institute and the co-director of the Non-Malignant Transplant Program at Seattle Children's Hospital. He's also a member of the IDF Medical Advisory Committee and a great champion of ours. So if you would please join me in welcoming Dr. Torgerson.
Thank you.
All right, so this can be super informal, but there's a few of it. So tell me, so I heard a little bit, each of you, so everybody here has the autosomal dominant form, so STAT3, Jake syndrome,
yes.
Everybody? No?
I actually work at NIH.
Mm-hmm.
I actually work with Dr. Helms, too.
Okay.
You might know her.
I know her.
You know her.
Yeah.
So, I came to the firm, a great learning center for me. I work on a scholar and bring in a good impression of revolution. And it will help me take care of my patients better. Because I have a lot of the recessive, which is a lot of Dr.
Yeah. All right. I wasn't planning on talking a lot about Dr.
Yeah.
But you can if you want. So most of what I've got is oriented around the autosomal dominant aspect. So I'm just going to you guys have a diagnosis from your school. Okay, great. And the daughter?
Daughter, Caroline, she's 14.
Okay.
Diagnosed with like tumescence for me. And she's VC. Her specialist in Austin is an infectious disease specialist that she's under Dr. Freeman here.
All right. Well, we have, in Seattle, we've been involved in hyperIgM syndrome for a long time. That you're probably aware of this. So I'll get there in a second. So I wanted to just sort of just cover a few things. And this can be total discussion. If these topics are not of interest to you, what I tried to do was pull some think tanks and relatively recent literature that's been published, some recent stuff. And I don't know whether you've got questions about sort of the basic and some of the basic biology, but if you've got questions about that, and we can certainly go through that a little bit too. This can be completely open. This is for you guys, and we'd love to have you ask questions that would be of value. So I was just going to go through a little bit of background, and we can talk more or less about that. And then I've highlighted a few things: infection, dentition, and treatment specifically. I've got a number of things highlighted in the infection section, but treatment, particularly, sort of an update on sort of where we're at with lung nodule or infectious. There's a lot of lung nodule. There is some more data, including some publishers that I'll show you the New York Times. So I'll which Dr. Andy Jenry sent me. So. This is how we sort of got initially involved in hyperIgM syndrome. This paper was actually clinically described initially in this detail by the guy that I consider sort of my academic grandfather. So the guy that I did my postdoctoral fellowship with did his postdoctoral fellowship with Ralph Wedgwood. And Ralph Wedgwood is actually still alive, still, he periodically shows up at the clinic in the hospital, and sort of he's in his 90s. He's of the Wedgwood China family. He and his brother were sent to the States to go to medical school during World War II by their family, and he became a pediatric immunologist and really did a lot of early things related to both pediatric immunology and pediatric rheumatology. So among them is that he was involved in describing which they call Joe syndrome. I sort of joked that this may have been the last time that the Bible was quoted in the Lancet. Because, anyway, they quoted
this verse from Job, which is how it came to be called Job syndrome. And so this was published in The Lancet in 66, I believe, 66 or 65. And it described these two young women. One of them, this young woman, died not long after this picture was taken at the age of 17. This young woman, we took care of until recently. She was in her mid-50s and passed away. They both originally were described, they were red-headed girls. As you can see from the pictures, both of them were red-headed girls. And so originally there was some question as to whether or not the red hair was part of the syndrome as well for a long time. So we now know that that's not the case. But the two of these two initially were both redhead. So anyway, that's how we got involved in it, and then we collected a lot of patients over the years related to that, and you guys are all familiar with the clinical features of this disease, of the autosomal dominant form. So there are, as you know, there are sort of distinct facial features that develop over time. There are fungal infections, typically cutaneous, nasal cutaneous handle infections, something that is brushed sometimes, and fingernail infection often. Of course, the staphylococcal pneumonias that can lead to the formation of what we call pneumatic seals or holes in the lungs because of we think that there's an intrinsic problem with the healing in the lungs after the infection. And of course, once those have formed, then they're susceptible to having a super infection. They're not the things like fungi. Connective tissue problems, so hyperextensibility is common. Of course, scoliosis, fractures that can happen sometimes with very little trauma. The eczema, the retained teeth, and then, of course, the vascular aneurysms that have been described in different organs, hearts and brain areas in patients. So this is sort of the spectrum of disease, and it kind of highlights the fact that this is a, you know, the gene, STAT3, is expressed in essentially every cell in the body. And so its effects play a role in which there is also this systemic disorder, not just a hematopoietic or a blood systemic disorder. So that plays a role when, you know, as we've thought about bone marrow transplant for which we're going to get to at the end, it plays a role in because with bone marrow transplant you only replace the hematopoietic system, you replace the blood forming cells. There's a question about how much of the syndrome will bone marrow transplant potentially cure. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Because I think there's a couple of things there. We don't know definitively yet, but there's a couple of things there that are encouraging that I think maybe are interesting. So I don't know how much, you know, I think the molecular biology of this is interesting and sort of basic. And I just wanted to say just a couple of minutes on that, just to make sure that we're all on the same page of how this happens sort of really at the molecular level, what happens inside the cell. And how does this one little change in one amino acid, actually, usually, is what happens. How does that one little misplaced amino acid cause problems? Because I think that it's interesting, and it hopefully will be interesting to you. So the mutations that we've seen in patients with hyper IgE syndrome cluster in five major domains of this protein. Okay, so each of these, this is the protein here to here, and each of these is a domain. But what I mean by a domain is it's a chunk of the protein that performs a particular function. And so I kind of think that, you know, the proteins in our cells, they're kind of like Legos in a way. You know, you sort of have
you have yellow blocks, red blocks, and the yellow blocks do one particular thing, the red blocks do another particular thing, and you can assemble proteins by sort of putting together these different functional domains, and that dictates what the function of that protein is. And so this is where all of the mutations in hyper-IgE syndrome cluster, and it turns out that there are two point mutations. There's two amino acid changes. There's one in the DNA binding domain, and there's one in the SH2 domain. So there's two different mutations that account for about two-thirds of all the patients with hyper-IgE syndrome. And that's important for us as we think about ways that we might be able to, in the future, design therapies to go in and potentially, so there are now technologies available to edit DNA. We're still doing gene therapy, but we're sort of moving even beyond gene therapy now, where we can go in and potentially identify and change these very specific areas. We're not quite there yet, but I think that this is potentially feasible down the line. And I think the problem with these approaches is that oftentimes you have to design a specific for each mutation, you have to design sort of a specific region. So the nice thing with hyper-IgE syndrome is that since two mutations account for two-thirds of the patients, you can design two reagents that could potentially treat two-thirds of the patients. So that's sort of, I think that's where the field ultimately is heading. We're not there yet, but I do think that it does provide some opportunities potentially. This is a very, compared to some of the other immunodeficiencies where the mutations are more spread across the gene, makes it a much more attractive target because we've got two areas that we can target and treat many. So again, one of those is here, one of those is here. And depending on which domain it's in, it sort of changes how the protein functions. And so the bottom line with this is that this protein is a protein that's called a transcription factor. It goes into the nucleus, and I'll show you in a second, and it binds to the DNA, and it regulates how genes are transcribed in the nucleus. So I think of these as sort of switches that turn DNA transcription on and off, and it has a whole set of genes that it binds to the DNA around those genes, and what it does is it attracts the machinery that comes in and copies those genes to turn them into RNA, which then gets turned into proteins. And so it's a way to sort of change a whole set of genes, and it binds to DNA. Let me show you how it does that, because it's kind of...
If we had the test by the NIH, would they have determined which of those two things it was?
Yeah, they know the specific mutation. If the testing was done there, they know the specific mutation. Yeah. So this is the protein. So this is the crystal structure of the protein. So the protein, one subunit of the protein is here. Like that's one subunit, and this is the other subunit of the protein. Here. Okay, so it forms a dimer, and this is the DNA. And so imagine that you're looking down the strand of the DNA, sort of at the end of it. You're looking kind of down the barrel of the DNA, so it's sort of going into the screen away from you. Okay, and this this clamps onto the DNA like a pair of pliers, and it's pairing. It's sort of tied together up here at the top through an interaction that's up here at the top. So it literally is like a pair of pliers. So you've got the little pin in the pliers that allows you to do that. It's literally like that. This is like the pin. And here's the part that clamps onto the DNA. And there's actually another part that's up top. So it really does look kind of like a pair of pliers. And it clamps onto the DNA. And when it does that, what it does is it attracts the machinery that comes in and copies whichever gene this is bound to. So if this binds to the DNA at a site of a gene, what happens is that the machinery comes in and sees that, it's attracted to that, and then it copies the gene that this is attached to. Okay. So it's like a switch. It turns on and off gene transcription. And so it regulates. Part of the reason that you get so many symptoms with this disease
is because it's regulating a whole bunch of different genes. It's probably regulating 500 to 1,000 different genes. So that's why the clinical symptoms are so broad with disease. So the question is, why does then just one, a mutation in just one? So let me show you how this works, actually, before we move on. So the way that this works is that these proteins, these STAT proteins, STAT3, they're out in the cytoplasm of the cell. So just to orient you, this is a slice out of the cell. So there's the outer membrane of the cell. Here's the nuclear membrane. Here's the DNA down here in the nucleus, okay? And these guys sit out in the cytoplasm of the cell. They're floating around. They're not active, okay? So they, they're just sort of floating around and waiting for something to come along and activate them. Now, what happens is that when growth factors, cytokines, which are sort of like the hormones that the immune system secretes these cytokines, they're sort of like hormones or signals that they secrete to tell each other what to do and to grow and divide and all that stuff. When they bind to their receptors, which is here, those receptors have attached to them these enzymes that attach phosphates to these tyrosine molecules here. So basically what happens is that the cytokine binds, the receptor gets activated, the phosphates get attached to here. These have, the STAT3 has a domain, one of the domains that can come in and can actually bind to those phosphate, those tyrosine residues that have phosphates on them. They bind here. Then that enzyme, that kinase, it phosphorylates the STAT3, so it does that. And then the STAT3 actually flips and becomes, so before this happens, it's like you took a pair of pliers and you twisted them. So you've got one handle up here and one handle down here. And then after it undergoes this change, this phosphorylation change, then you sort of flip them so the handles are back together and they work like pliers. Does that make sense? So that's what happens. And so activation of by the cytokines changes it. It flips into the plier conformation. It goes into the nucleus. It binds to DNA. It changes how those genes get expressed. And then eventually what happens is that there's another enzyme that comes in and takes off these phosphates, and then it flips into that other weird conformation where you've got one handle of the plier up here and one handle down here, and then it gets sent back out of the nucleus, back into the cytoplasm. So it can be turned on and turned off, okay? So that's what it does. And it does this because it's bound together as a pair. It's what we call a dimer. There's two subunits of STAT3 that get together and to form the pliers, because you've got to have right? So that's what happens. Okay, so what happens in hyper-IgE syndrome is this, that you get a pair of pliers, one half of the pliers doesn't work. It's not able to, so maybe it's not able to bind to DNA, or maybe it's not able to stick to the receptor like it's supposed to, or one of those things. So it changes the ability of the STAT3 proteins to be able to do all of those things, to flip into the plier conformation, to be able to go to the nucleus and bind to DNA like it's supposed to. Now, we know from mouse studies that if you totally take away STAT3, if you knock STAT3 out of the mouse DNA so that they just don't have any, it's not compatible with life. Those mice die. We also know that if you know you have two copies of the STAT3 gene, you get one on the chromosome that you get from mom, and one on the chromosome that you get from dad. Okay? We know that you can actually take away one of those, and it seems like the mice are totally fine. So you go from 100%, which is two copies, down to 50%, and it seems like they're totally fine. And we actually think that that's also the case in humans, because we've never found a patient with hyper-IgE syndrome who is completely lacking one copy. So who has one severe mutation in STAT3, we've never found one. Now, as many patients as we've found who have these point mutations, I am 100% certain that there are people running around out there who have severe mutations in STAT3 who've completely lost one copy, and they are fine. They don't have disease. Okay? So what that means is that 100% of STAT3 is two copies, 0%, it would be neither copy working, and that we think that that's incompatible with Y. 50%, or one copy, is probably fine. That's probably enough function. What happens in hyper-IgE syndrome is this, is that you wind up somewhere between 0 and 50%. And the reason for that is that you have two copies. You've got one, what we call wild type or normal copy, which is the one that doesn't have the mutation in it. And then you have one copy that has the mutation in it. And what happens is that, as you can imagine, inside the cell you're going to get, because it makes these pairs, you're going to get these pairings. Okay? And so you'll have 25% of the STAT3 that's the normal together. You'll have 25% that's mutant normal, 25% that's normal mutant, and 25% that's mutant. And any of these that contain the one that has the mutation in it, they don't work. Okay? And so what it does is it knocks down the total STAT3 function by 75% and leaves with about 25%. And so we've done a lot of studies and have shown that in fact this is the case, that patients with hyper-IgE syndrome have in the neighborhood of 20 to 30% of the baseline STAT3 function. And so that's why they have this disease. It just is not enough that when it goes in as the pliers and it sticks to all of those sites in the DNA and it regulates all those genes, it's not enough to regulate those to a normal level. And so that's how this works and why it causes such a broad spectrum of clinical syndromes. And it's also part of the reason why we think that it varies from person to person, because it, you know, as you can imagine, you know, each person's makeup, DNA makeup is a little bit different, and it may be that even patients who have the exact same mutation, because they've got differences in other parts of their DNA, they may, you know, that mutant protein may find a little bit better in one person than it does in another, just because of other changes that they have. So that's part of the reason that this is really creates a syndrome of clinical symptoms as opposed to just one variation. So that's kind of the basic biology, and the way that we make the diagnosis is really based on these things. So we use a couple of approaches to make the diagnosis. One of those is, of course, you can just sequence the gene. And as I mentioned, those two hot spots, what we call hot spots, where there's a lot of mutations, one of those is here, where there's that. You see each one of those dots is a different patient with the mutation, and the other one is here. And all the others are mutations that are kind of scattered through the gene. So you can sequence the gene. You can also look at whether or not the STAT3 protein gets phosphorylated and gets activated. In only about 50% of patients, any of the patients who have mutations in this part of the gene will have abnormalities in the in this phosphorylation test, and so we can do this as a way to test. And then one of the other things that we know that's been reported is that patients with hyper-IgE syndrome have low, what we call Th17 cells. These are, the T cells are a particular type of, the T cells are kind of the generals, the assassins, and the security guards of the immune, I should say the assassins, the security guards, and the psychologists, actually, of the immune system. They kind of direct the immune response. So they're one of the types of white blood cells. And there's different types of these T cells. And one of the types is a type that secretes this cytokine, which is called interleukin-17 or IL-17. And it turns out that IL-17 in the normal human immune system is really important for controlling fungal infection, and particularly candida, on the surface of on your skin and on your nails. And so it turns out that patients with hyper-IgE syndrome have very few of these Th17 cells. They make very little of this IL-17 cytokine. And we think that's why part of it is why they're susceptible to mucocutaneous tangles. So that's shown here that these are the, so here's a normal individual, and these are those these Th17 cells, these T cells that secrete IL-17, and here's a patient with Jobe syndrome, and you see that there's just not nearly as many. Each one of these dots is a cell, and as you can see in this patient with Jobe syndrome, there's just very few cells that
that are making their eyes. So we use this spectrum of studies to make the diagnosis. And it's really based on kind of our basic biology, right?
So anyway, I'd be happy to answer any questions about that if you've got any questions. That was more just sort of for interest's sake and just sort of, I think that, you know, I think it's important for patients to understand as much as they can about the basic and the basic biology of the disease. That would be worthwhile to walk through that. Any questions that I can answer about that?
Can it be about anything?
About anything. Absolutely.
Well, I don't know if
anything's
related.
No, it could be about anything.
She's had some CAT scans, and there are soon to be spots, like there are spots on her foot. Dr. Freeman kind of said that like, they see them in other Joe's patients. I'm not really sure what they are. Have you seen that?
We have, yeah, and as you say, we don't know for sure what they are. The if there's not pathology, you know, nobody's anxious about going and doing biopsies and trying to figure those out. Because we know that there can be aneurysms in the brain and other things, and we don't know whether those could be small areas where there are vascular anomalies. The vascular studies that have been done don't seem to support that. So you can do an MRI test where you can look more at the blood vessels. Even you may not be able to see the super small ones, but down to pretty small sizes. And it's not clear that those correlate with those lesions. It's not clear that those are vascular in origin. You know, we're always worried because of the susceptibility to infections, you're worried that there might be some infectious process. But most of the patients we see those are not symptomatic, and they don't think they think that it's something infectious. So we don't know what they are. SAT3 is involved in a lot of healing processes as well. And so, you know, could they be little scars? Could they be used to use them?
And what you're saying, those spots on the brain increase through the years? Like you started out with 3 and then...
So we've actually seen them move. So sometimes we'll see one that will resolve and then that they'll have new ones that will show up. It shakes us. Is it an inflammatory process? Are they, because we've certainly seen patients who have accumulated, but we've also seen patients, like I said, where they've had some, we come back a couple of years later and they've been, they may have one or two, and if they think that they've gotten fixed, sometimes they need it, and they need something. So I think it's unclear, and a lot of times it comes from that, you're able to get tissue, it's very difficult. But it's, you know, the risk. So what we do with the brain, I mean, the reason we do scans is more to screen for the and get guidance. Let me talk about, there are a few just clinical things that I wanted to run through, and you guys will have lots of experience with these, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. The problem that I will say is that there's not a lot of solid clinical data about how we should do some of these things. And so, as you probably learned from talking to one another and interacting online and other things, the approach to how we do some of these things varies. You ask for you know, just you get by the that's unfortunately something covered. So you know about infections. You know that, of course, Staphylococcus, Candida, Aspergillus are sort of, you know, what I consider to be the major players in issues of disease. And so they're the ones that we think about most often. Now, of course, there are other potential infections as well, but these are the ones that we
Staphylococcus, of course, is a bacteria, and then aspergillus is a fungus. The aspergillus, we typically don't see, unless a person has already had, the most common place that we see is in cavitary lesions in the lung. So it's sort of it's not a primary, but it's sort of a secondary, staff in Canada are able to enjoy primary infections. And of course, the problem with staphylococcal lung infections, which most patients get at some point, is that they leave behind. So in normal individuals, staph can cause cavitations in the lung. So it can cause, in normal folks, it's just it's got this ability to sort of destroy lung tissue. The problem in the hyper-IgE patients is that because STAT3 is expressed in not just, in the hematopoietic red blood cells, because it's expressed in all cells, we also think that there's an intrinsic healing problem with lung tissue itself. And that's based on, there is some data in a mouse model, take it for what you will, but there is some data in a mouse model where they knock out STAT3 function in the lung epithelial cells. And when they damage the lung in that mouse model, the damage that they used, it wasn't an infection. They used a high percentage of oxygen. If you use very high level oxygen, it can cause toxicity to the cells in the epithelial cells. This study is actually done by a rheumatologist who of course, they've got babies in the care unit where they're using ventilation and high level oxygen. And so, but what they, in this mouse model, they injured the epithelial cells with 100% oxygen. And then what they showed is that the epithelial cells that were lacking STAT3, the lung epithelial cells, didn't migrate back in across the lesion. So when they were damaged, they didn't migrate back in across those lesions like normal epithelial cells do. So that has suggested to us that there is an intrinsic healing problem with how the lung repairs itself after, and because staph has this ability to sort of destroy lung tissue sort of intrinsically, even in normal folks, if you pair that then with an inability for the lung to heal itself appropriately, then the susceptibility for developing these cavitary lesions and lesions is very high. So we think that that's the mechanism that we should happen. So, and of course, once you get those, then those areas are susceptible to cooling fluid and it's been culturally for other organisms. So that becomes a challenge. And so, really, the best approach would be to prevent that. Unfortunately, because this only requires one mutation to cause the disease, most patients actually appear sporadically. There's no family history. Probably about 75% of patients have no family history. But since you don't need mutations in both genes, it can happen just randomly. And so what happens is that, in our experience, that patients a lot of times may not come to light until they show up actually the first time with staphylococcal pneumonia or other things. And so it's a challenge to prevent that. And I would say that, as I say here, that there's not good agreement on the best method for antibiotic prophylaxis for bacterial infections. People have tried all sorts of things. We tend to use drugs that are very good at preventing staph. The problem is with all of the methicillin-resistant MRSA out in the community now, that of course, is a challenge. And so we end up in many patients rotating antibiotics. So I don't know what your experience is, but we may have patients. And again, this is sort of made up by us in collaboration with our infectious diseases. And my suspicion is, again, that there's no data on this that I'm aware of in the literature about the best way to do this.
typically do is we typically rotate drugs like Keflex, which treats the methicillin-sensitive form of staph, with Bactrim, which treats the methicillin-resistant form. So we, instead of putting patients on two at the same time, oftentimes we'll rotate those. A month is what we typically do. Again, I have no data to say that that's the right thing to do. We sort of, I'll be completely honest, we make this up.
That's not like a good study for that. So would you, you said that you kind of rotate it every month. Is that like kind of a general idea that it should be rotated?
And if it works.
The sporadic, like,
and if it works, then I would say there's no reason to change. You know, I think the.
Our stuff, like, if there's a breakthrough infection,
that's what
I have another one.
Yep.
And what is your sign on?
Right now, I'm not talking about the first of the episode.
We have a very high rating of MRSA in our community, so we've got about 45% of the accidents in the community are MRSA. That's sort of where we came up with, you know. And the problem with Bactrim in that study is we worry about that it will become ineffective. So that's why we rotate on and off. If we can get organism to culture, you know, if they've got MRSA, then we don't switch them to one that obviously don't switch them to one that doesn't treat the MRSA. But Bactrim is a great maintenance drug. It actually, we've got there's a long history of chronic use of Bactrim in other immunodeficiency diseases, so like chronic immunodeficiency diseases where patients are on a lot of intolerant or just one. So it's a fantastic maintenance drug, and again, there's very little data. I think what we have, there's a lot of anecdotal data, from individual patients who are treated in a certain way that people study. But unfortunately, no one has done sort of a large trial to sort of look at, either retrospectively or prospectively, at the best regimens. So I would say, you know, if you're not rotating, you know, as long as you're not having problems, then stick with what you're doing. We change the rotation even more in the patients who are having more problems. I had one patient when we were rotating on recommendation with infectious disease docs, based on the isolated organism that we had, we rotated four antibiotics, and we were rotating every 2 weeks. So again, there's very little data. Try it. Try what you're doing if you're doing a breakthrough and try it. Our goal is in the patients who have not had staphylococcal infections, lung infections, is to really try to prevent those. That plays such a big role down the line in terms of just the additional complications that come after the formation of the ICU, that we really make every effort to try to prevent those. So for us, you know, the skin abscesses and other things, not that they're not terrible and cause a lot of discomfort, those are much, in terms of the long-term challenges that arise, are much less worrisome than the long-term challenges. Precisely. Truly, yes, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right.
As a parent, I totally support what you just said.
Yeah.
She's constantly covered, which then kind of inhibits, like, goes back to the cycle of the heat.
Yeah.
And I think for Frank and Gloria, you're never going to hear him, so you don't get the resonance. Yeah. Quite as much. But yeah.
I can imagine. That's actually on my list, actually. So The other thing is, I was just going to say
that's all right. That's all right. That's fine. This is meant to be a discussion. The other thing I was going to say is there's not great agreement on how to best approach the fungal infections. We don't typically prophylax for them until patients have. So that's sort of been our approach. Do you guys do bleach baths? Yeah. So for those of you who don't, this is from the American Academy of Dermatology website. It's really nice in terms of this is what I give to patients to really describe what to do. No. I would say most patients do, but not everybody. And usually the most common thing is fingernails and brush. Or toenails. So you probably can. It's just that you have to dilute it a lot. And I think this is from the American Academy of Dermatology website, and I think they're concerned that people won't and with concentrated bleach, you have to dilute it in quite a large volume. And I think their concern is that people will get burns. If there's too much, it can be a little too drying. So. Yeah. So anyway, this is the website that or the what I use to give to patients for those. I heard you guys talking about IgG replacement. So there is again, here's another area where there's a lot of anecdotal data. So what there is there are at least three very good studies on the B cells of patients with type 1 IgG diseases. And and those studies are all consistent in that they show that the B cells don't mature appropriately. And if they don't mature appropriately, they don't differentiate appropriately, they don't make antibodies appropriately. And so we've done a fair number of studies looking at vaccine responses in patients with GIST, and they were very abnormal. So there's some vaccines like tetanus, for instance, that's sort of like clobbering the immune system and such. So it's not a subtle vaccine. Patients with Jones syndrome will make antibodies to tetanus. It's when you get into the more subtle vaccines, the ones that aren't quite such a sledgehammer, things like MMR vaccine, carbohydrate vaccines like the kid and Coffle and those sorts of things, where the vaccines aren't such a sledgehammer to the immune system, so it's a more, the immune system really has to be able to fine-tune to really respond to it. And that's where we see the biggest problem.
So
he may not necessarily be well protected for him. But if he's on MVHG, it's just pain infection and he's fine. So we've got pretty well, actually a very good figure, but we have a test vaccine that we use in Seattle, and which is again more of a subtle vaccine, and it very clearly shows that patients with Jobe syndrome don't that their initial response is not as good as normal individuals, and that when we do boosters, that they don't boost like normal individuals do. So there's a very clear B-cell defect in Jones syndrome. And based on that, it's our practice to give patients IgG based on that finding. That is not universal, however. So you may have run into physicians who don't necessarily support the use of IgG. In fact, there's one of the guys who's done a lot of this work who's in Europe, Bo Grimbacher, is really kind of been, at least in the past, I don't know if he's still this way, but until at least 6 or 8 months ago when we talked about it a lot, he was not very positive about the use of IgG or as an immunoglobulin therapy in Jones syndrome. Anecdotally, again, the patients that we treat, I think they do better when they're on IgG replacement therapy. They get fewer infections,
I think our experience has been with the scan is a little bit easier to manage, and we need to agree with other patients.
That's why the problem
is
there's no
definitive
study.
Exactly. And that's why we have sometimes struggle with justifying these features. It's an important, I mean, it's an expensive therapy, and so, you know, they push back. So we've been successful in all the cases. When we just show them, we do B-cell studies on all of the patients, so we look at memory, So it's a clinically available panel to look at memory B-cells and switch memory B-cells. It's a panel that we use. It's now part of the diagnostic criteria for a different immunodeficiency called CVID. But we use that same panel in these patients, and it's almost universal.
Okay.
No, actually, we don't do it yearly because it doesn't really change. So we do it once initially, and we use that as to assist in our justification. Because we say there's a clear B cell abnormality, and you know that this patients who have this sort of B cell abnormality, like the CVID patients, need IgG. Therefore, this patient needs IgG. So that's how we do it. So it's one more piece of data if you're having a hard time getting your IgG covered.
So now to the dental thing. So
as you know well, 75% of patients have significant dental problems. And I think the best. This is a nice. Paper that was published in 2012 from a group in Milan, Italy, from a group of dentists, and they in this followed prospectively, actually, for a long period of time, six patients. So it's not a huge study, but it's six patients with hyper IgD syndrome that they followed and screened using a variety of approaches that dentists use. Panorex x-rays like this, regular oral exams, and the bottom line of this is that they really, you know, patients had a wide array of problems. And this was their bottom line, is that, which is just that patients with hyper-IgD syndrome need probably more visual intensive care even than individuals. So they need regular visits to the dentist, regular visits if there's structural abnormalities, regular visits to the orthodontist. And they say these things, that the orthodontist should recognize the syndromic picture of the patients with hyper-IgD syndrome and follow both the skeletal and dental development because of the facial development abnormalities that can occur sometimes, they need to stay on top of that. And that they need to extract at the appropriate time. So if the teeth aren't coming out, we need to get those extracted and out of there. That they need to be pretty aggressive, actually. Their take was that the dentist and orthodontist need to be pretty aggressive about the extraction. So when they see the new teeth coming in, they need to get the old ones out to allow the new ones to come in. And that's going to improve the results. So you can pull out this paper. They suggest, and again, this is a dental group. They suggest prophylactic extraction, basically. That when you start to see the other teeth ready to come in, that you get the old ones out to allow the new ones to come in. That was their take. Again, it was only six patients, but it's not a huge study, but I do think that of all of the studies that I'm aware of that have been done on the dental part of this disease, this is probably the most complete, that has been published. The NIH may have some other data.
Well, it seems maybe they're saying it because of be aggressive in it because of the further complex treatment.
Yes.
I think that is probably then you start getting into
Yeah, and she's still relatively young, so they, you know, she's still got a window before there's...
This is
at it by 7, if she's not losing stuff, then we're going to start more aggressive with the dental. She's got a year then. She's very mad and too paranoid, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, exactly. Lots of makeup too. And then of course good oral hygiene. So that was their recommendation. And so this is the paper.
This is the name of the journal. Oral surgery, oral medicine, oral pathology, oral, what a terrible name, oral radiology. I'm happy to send you a copy of the slides if you want.
Yeah,
I'm like. So, but I think that this, like I said, this, in terms of what's published in the literature, this is probably the best that I see for patients.
Did you have other specific questions?
I've not seen a lot of notes so this disease. We've seen this disease.
When you've got
something like a severe infection, like, I mean, yes, we're this year, and then we'll just rinse,
but not.
Do they come in crops?
Pretty much.
Really?
Like, on the side of a
I've never used this in a hyper IgE syndrome patient, so please just take that for what it's worth. But in patients who, I've had other patients who've had chronic recurrent mouth ulcers, so aphthous stomatitis, who are treated with colchicine, which is a drug that they use it for some infectious things. It also has effects on neutrophils, so it might, it's not a terribly aggressive immunosuppressant, but it's more of an immunomodulatory agent. And I've had good luck in some patients who've got recurrent mouth sores with colchicine. It may be a bad idea in a hyperemesis syndrome patient. I'm not sure. It's not enough immunosuppressive that I would feel terribly anxious about using it. I think it's, in terms of its anti-inflammatory or even immunomodulatory effects, sort of like ibuprofen, or Plaquenil, sort of mild or immunosuppressive immunomodulatory. And I've had very good luck with it in a subset of patients who have just tons of mouth sores. Sometimes it helps. So might be something to talk about it for a while. You can do a therapeutic trial and see, it would be one thing to potentially try.
So that's the dental piece. That's all I really wanted to share there. It was just this paper, I think, which again, I think they did a, if you get the paper and look at it, they looked at every patient in exactly the same way, using a series of both radiographic and physical exam and other studies to evaluate.
Well, her adult teeth look like her baby teeth, because her baby teeth are either the face or they're square. Are the adult ones going to look the same?
It's a good question.
They could. Most of the time, the adult teeth that come in look fairly normal. It's not like, there are immunodeficiencies where that's not the case. So the jokes in the room don't see that. Once they're in, as long as you maintain the patients and maintain good old hygiene, they look pretty good. The problem is that sometimes because they're all sort of jammed up in there, they come in at weird angles, they do some strange things sometimes, which is pretty good for them to be very helpful.
Yeah. Does it help?
It's so anyway. So, but they, I would think they would look okay. I wanted to just touch on bone marrow transplant because I think there is now a little bit more data on bone marrow transplant for this disease. I'm going to just start up front and say the problem with bone marrow transplant is that we have absolutely no idea who to take the treatment. So we don't know the biomarkers that are going to, which patients are going to have a more severe course of patients. That's the challenge at this point. So let me show you the history. I'll show you everything that we know about bone marrow transplant to today. This is the first patient that was reported in 1998. It was an older patient, a 46-year-old male, who was treated for bone marrow transplant with a large B-cell lymphoma. He died. So what's interesting here is that as you see, this is his IgE level, and then he was transplanted, okay? He died 6 months post-transplant. He died of an interstitial pneumonitis, basically his lungs basically filled up with inflammatory cells. And I think now we would sort of assume that was probably graft versus host disease, probably, and he would have been treated accordingly. So I don't know that for sure. They didn't find any infectious organisms in the patient, but he died 6 months after transplant. So again, that's the first report in 1998. This is the report that has, and I put the actual title of the paper on here because it actually, I think that this one paper has set back our understanding of bone marrow transplant. Because when this paper came out, if you read the title, that sort of discouraged people from trying. And I know Andy Jenner is actually here. Fantastic, spectacular immunologist, bone marrow transplanters in Newcastle. Just a massive amount of experience in bone marrow transplant. And I've asked them about this paper, and they both feel terrible. They wish that they could recant this title. Because it turns out that over time, the patient did in fact get better and has had some infections. So this is the story. They reported one patient, this was in 2000, this paper was published, who had initial improvement after transplant. So as you can see, the IgE levels went down nicely. But then in about 2 years post-transplant, the IgE levels went up again, and the patient began to have infections again. So had some fungal infections, viral infections, so had CMV, staphylococcal and pseudomonal skin infections, and elevated IgE, and despite having full bone marrow. And so they published this paper basically saying, the hyper-IgE syndrome. Now that this patient is a little bit further out, this has actually settled down a little bit. The IgE has actually trended back down again here. And I don't know if it's completely normal in this patient, and the infections have tapered off. So it's not entirely clear what happened. We do know that things like chronic graft versus host disease can make you susceptible to infections. Elevated IgE levels and eosinophil problems and other things. It wasn't clear that this patient had chronic graft versus host disease, but that was one consideration. So this is a paper published in 2000. Like I said, I think just the title discouraged people from trying bone marrow transplant in this disease. So in 2010, this paper was published from a Greek group, and they published actually long-term follow-up in two patients that had been transplanted because of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, two hyper-IgE patients. These patients were 10 and 14 years post-transplant, so long time post-transplant. And to read this paper, it's actually very encouraging, actually. So note here, the IgE levels before, so maximum in these two patients, 50,000 and 20,000. And here are the IgE levels after transplant, 107 and 14. Okay.
So as a marker of this of the disease improving, the IgE levels got better. They also report that one of the patients had very significant osteoporosis, which we know that patients had, sort of osteopenia, you know, low, if you get the D-score, the bone density studies done, the bone density is often low in patients with IgE syndrome, which is what leads to the fractures. And that improved in that patient who had low bone density. That got better after transplant. And it makes some sense because because the cells, the osteoclasts that break down, so there's osteoblasts that build bone, there's osteoclasts that break down bone, and it's this ongoing process of building, breaking down, remodeling that's happening all the time in all of us. The osteoclasts are derived from hematopoietic cells, from blood cells, and so it may be that replacing those was what was needed. And so, at least in this one case report, this patient did have improvement in the bone density. Okay, so that's encouraging. They also state that there was a softening of the facial features, that they were not quite so stark. And the hypothesis, again, was that this may have had to do with remodeling of the bony structure related to replacement with normal osteoclasts. So these patients had done well, had not had significant infections after the transplant, and had not had significant graft versus host disease, and like I said, they're now, this is in 2010, so five years over each one of these, and they're a long ways out post-transplant,
and have done well. I've connected with these investigators since then, recently actually, to get an update, and the patients, they said the patients are still doing well. Okay. So there's that data. There's a paper that we just published in collaboration with a group in South Carolina on a single patient who got a haploidentical transplant. So when it comes to bone marrow transplants, you've got a choice in donors for the bone marrow transplant, and ideally you want the best donor is a matched sibling. Is the best donor, but not anybody come in that sibling. The next best is a matched unrelated donor, typically. And then our choice is we typically then go to a cord blood donor as our next. And then our last choice is a haploidentical donor. A haploidentical donor is somebody who's only half matched. So the risks of being half matched are there's a higher risk that the graft will be rejected, and there's a higher risk for graft versus host disease. So basically, there's a higher risk that there's going to be, because of the incompatibility between the host and the donor, there's a higher risk of those two things. So it makes increased risk in those sides. This patient was actually very complicated because she was a teenager. She had actually had spinal rods placed not long before the surgery for her severe scoliosis, and those had become infected and had to be taken out. And so she also had lung issues and was having some challenges around that. Partly because of the scoliosis, she was having some respiratory challenges. That was the reason to do the spinal rods. So she was not the best candidate for bone marrow transplant, but she was a teenager and she told her parents, and so she did, and the transplant was successful. her IgE level is here, so pre-transplant 4,300, post-transplant 25. Her infections have all resolved. She's not had major problems with infections. She had one of the mutations that had poor STAT3 phosphorylation. Remember that test I showed you earlier? This is the normal control. This is unstimulated cells here and then stimulated cells. And if it shifts over, that means it's good. If it's normal, hers just shifted a little bit before transplant, but after transplant, completely normalized because she's got donor cells. And her Th17 cells, here pre-transplant, she had almost none, and post-transplant, she's got a normal population of these Th17 cells like normal. So she's completely completely reconstituted and is doing quite well. She has.
So that's not gotten better.
I guess the question is, if you did this earlier, could you prevent that from happening? I think it's not clear. I think that you know. So her scoliosis hasn't gotten better. She's, but because she heals better generally, she's sort of tolerated it a little bit better. Have not had to do spinal surgery.
So that's her. That's, again, a single patient. And then lastly is data that Andy Jennery just sent me. They
now, in Newcastle, because it didn't work in that initial patient, they treated four more. Who knows? It did. I mean, I think that tells you that they really do feel like it works. So they treated four more. So they're getting ready to submit a publication on five patients now that they've treated. The patients range in age from 6 to 17 years at the time of transplant, and every one of the patients that they transplanted had significant pulmonary pathology, meaning that they had each of the patients had pneumatoceles, bronchiectasis, chronic lung disease, etc. when they went to transplant, which makes the transplant riskier. So these would be relatively moderate to higher risk transplants. Given that, however, all of the patients are alive, they're fully engrafted from the donor. Some of them have some GVHD, but GVHD has not been a tremendous problem in these patients. There are two patients who've had post-transplant infections. One of the patients is a patient that I mentioned to you before, a viral and some cutaneous infection. And they've got another patient who did get aspergillus infections after the transplant. They think that that's probably more related to just being very immunosuppressed than the initial period post-transplant, and the patient was successfully treated. Continues to be on fungal prophylaxis. So all five patients are actually doing quite well. I don't know about the other features. I don't know about the bone problems. I don't know about the teeth. I don't know any other details yet. Andy, you just sent me sort of a bare minimum data set. They're just pulling everything together.
What's the time frame when you start thinking about allowing them approved to do a bone marrow transplant?
So the initial part to, once you decide that you want to do a bone marrow transplant, the first thing you have to do is find a donor. That typically takes up to a couple of months. Can be faster. If there's a matched sibling, that makes it very easy. But that often takes a couple of months to find a donor. And then you launch into the transplant. And typically the condition. So the way that I describe bone marrow transplant to my patients is that I tell them that your immune system is like it's like your military. It protects your homeland from being invaded by terrorists, so like bacteria, viruses, and stuff. And if your military is not doing the job, it's not protecting your homeland very well, then you might want to get rid of it, right, and replace it with someone else's. And so the problem is that it's there, it's already living in the barracks, it's in the bone marrow, and so what you have to do is you have to get rid of it first. So in this country, if we wanted to do that, we'd have to go in and we'd have to, gas all the barracks and get rid of all the guys living in the barracks. We've got to get all the new barracks, right, to get rid of them, so that we can make space to bring in a new military, right? And then we would go to the French government and say, we would like to just have, could you give us, maybe a fourth of your military? We're going to bring them into our barracks. We're going to, make them home. We'll put them to sleep. And for a little while, we'll bring them in. We'll just set them up in our barracks. And when they wake up, they're going to be in new barracks. And they're going to protect us, right? Well, that's what happens. Now, you can imagine what could go wrong in that situation, right? So, which kind of explains what goes wrong in bone marrow transplant. They wake up, and they say, where are we? There's no good cheese, there's no good wine, they we're not in France anymore, which means we're in a foreign country, maybe we better start fighting, right? So that's graft versus host disease, okay? The other option is that, all of us, we see these, we wake up one day and we see all these French guys running around in military uniforms and we think we're being overtaken.
And we say, wait a minute, we've been invaded. We better get rid of them. And so we start, you know, shooting at them and trying to build them up. And that's rat rejection. If you totally wipe them out, then that's a problem. Now, as you can imagine, if we borrowed a fourth of the French army, that's not even come close to filling all the barracks and protecting us in other places. And so they're going to need to grow and divide and make more of themselves, you know, to be able to make a full military to protect our country. But, you know, in order to do that, they've got to sort of make themselves at home in the barracks, they've got to get comfortable there and begin to work. And that's why it takes a while. So the bone marrow transplant includes all of those pieces. So there's a conditioning piece, which is the clearing out of the barracks, okay? That typically takes, for most bone marrow conditioning regimens, between a week and 2 weeks, okay? And then you infuse the bone marrow, or the peripheral blood stem cells, or the cord blood stem cells, and that's infused just like an IV. So it just goes in and they'll find their way to the barracks and the bone marrow and set up shop and, you know, make themselves at home. And begin to grow and divide and generate a new military. Now, there's a period there in the immediate post-transplant period that is between 2 weeks and a month where you've got almost no immune system. Okay, so that's the period where it's the greatest risk for infection. And then the immune system begins to come back. And by 6 months, there's certain parts of the immune system that are back to normal. By a year, there are more parts of the immune system. So the initial parts of the immune system that come back are like the neutrophils and the macrophages. They kind of come back first, the NK cells, the innate part of the immune system. It takes the lymphocytes longer to come back. So that they're mostly back to close to normal levels by around a year post-transplant, and usually by 2 years post-transplant, everything's pretty much back, everything's still working again, and everything's kind of back and working together. And I would say you're back to 90% of a normal immune system at that point. We don't see things totally and completely look like sort of a normal adult, you know, big kid adult immune system for up to 5 years post-transplant to be back to 100% normal. But it kind of makes sense because if you think about, you know, how normal development is, you know, babies have kind of their immune system is not particularly smart yet. You know, it's just starting out, and that's how you have to think about this. We're basically going to give you a baby immune system back, and you're going to have to develop. And so, you think about kids. You know, by 2 years of age, their immune system is a little bit more developed, and we know that by 2 years of age, they can respond to more things than they could prior to that. And then by the time they get to be about five, they should be able to respond to society. These transplants were done, and these kids range from 6 to 17 years of age at the time of transplant.
Right, but what year? Is there about the data?
Yeah, so the one was done, the oldest was 4 years prior to 2000, so 96, I think, was their earliest. And I think the others actually don't know exactly. He didn't send me the dates when they were transferred, so I don't know how far these are out. But typically people don't report outcomes of bone marrow transplant unless patients are at least 1 year post-transplant. So I would guess that all of these patients are at least 1 year out post-transplant.
And is it the same process? We have a run with the American Plastic and the same process as you do the chemo before the transplant.
Yes, and the chemo is the conditioning part. So the conditioning is usually a combination of chemotherapy drugs. Sometimes they use radiation, although that's not used quite as much these days. But typically it's a combination of chemotherapy drugs and really strong immunosuppressants.
And where does insurance stand on that?
Excellent question.
Published.
Yes. So that's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right. I think that once this case series of five is published, it will be easier to justify. I think the challenge of bone marrow transplant is that there's not very many cases in the literature proving that in fact it's efficacious, then we really have to fight for. We really have to fight the insurance company. Given that, however, we
I had one patient that took us 2 years. 2 years, many, many appeals. We actually had to go give in-person testimony to a committee of this insurance company to get this covered. The whole time the patient was doing worse and worse. This is her, actually her CVID patient. But we can typically get, twist their arms eventually to get it covered. So I think, but the more literature there is, the better and the easier it gets.
You were going to say, and I know you already said that there's not really, you can't say, oh, this would be a great candidate, or this would not be. When would you say that's like something to consider? At what point in a patient's life do you go, you know what, let's give this a shot?
Yeah. So, That's a great question. It's a very complicated moving question. So I'm going to, before I answer that, I'm going to give you my bias up front, which is that I I'm involved in a lot of transplants. So we are pretty aggressive at transplanting. And I am pro-transplant. I will say that right up front. I think that bone marrow transplant is a little thing. But I also, when I sit down with families, I also tell them, you know, bone marrow transplant, with bone marrow transplant, if we do it now, there's a reasonable chance that your child may not be here next Christmas. But there's also, you know, with bone marrow transplant, and that's comparing, you know, to just doing standard therapy. You know, if you're doing standard therapy, there's a better chance with bone marrow transplant that they won't be doing standard therapy. However, by doing the bone marrow transplant, there's also a better chance that they'll be here 30 Christmases from now than doing standard therapy. And that is, an incredibly, you know, this is an incredibly difficult decision. What I would say is, you know, one of the challenges is that, you know, what we've got to go on is sort of past standard therapy. And now we've got, you know, we're putting patients earlier on IVIG. I don't know how well patients are going to do if we put them on IVIG right up front, prophylactic antibiotic, et cetera, et cetera. I still think that the SAS patients are going to have benefit. I think, you know, they're still going to have challenges that. And again, bone marrow transplant is not going to fix all of those. So my inclination, and at this point, based on the data that we have, is that if you've got a patient who early on is having a lot of complications, a lot of significant complications that are happening early in life, that probably those are patients in which it should be considered before the lungs become so damaged that you can't do it. Because the most bone marrow transplant regimens have pulmonary exclusion criteria. If the lungs are not in good enough shape, then they won't be even considered for a bone marrow transplant. And that's the challenge with Jones syndrome, is that if the lungs become too bad, then you've missed an injury. And the data both in this study, so there in all of the patients, they, like I said, all of these patients had pre-existing lung disease in this beginning study before they were transplanted. So they had metastasis.
Is there a
newborn
screening for
hyper
IgE? Is there some skin?
No, there's not. And like I said, because a lot of the cases are sporadic, because they, you know, they occur where there's no family history, you know, many of you, your experience has been they show that, you know, sort of undiagnosed for a while, that the child is having a lot of infections, a lot of problems, and gets diagnosed. Sometimes after they've already had their staph complement. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so
we're not gonna need a bone marrow transplant because we bought a few food off.
There you go.
And she had the
possibility. Like, is that an MRI, is it an X-ray? Is
It's functional, actually. So that for bone marrow transplant, the exclusion criteria are based on functional pulmonary function criteria. So it's exactly, but a more sophisticated,
right.
You know, a full set of pulmonary function tests. So it has to do with how much volume can you inhale, how much can you exhale, and those are a pretty good measure of lung damage. So. No, the exclusion criteria for the transplant are functional criteria. So that's why I guess, you know, if you've got a patient who, you know, if you've got somebody maybe they've had a very early staphylococcal pneumonia, you know, maybe an infant or a young child, I would probably think about it because the problem is that that's a setup then for recurrent infections and other things, and you may. You want to sort of that it means that the window could close.
Because lung transplant, is that something that high priority patients are doing?
So not typically. So it's a great question, and it's been considered. And I think that there's just almost no data. The problem with lung transplants is that lung transplants in normal individuals are not great. And so you add that on top of that into someone who may have challenges with recurrent infections and other things, and it makes it potentially even worse. So I think that we don't really know. And the one thing that Andy did note, and he did tell me, was that their lung disease, so when you do a CT scan, you can see, of course, the chronic damage, you can see the scarring, but you can also often see areas where there's inflammation, where the inflammatory cells are sort of infiltrated into the lung. And that part of the lung got better. So the areas where there was inflammatory infiltrate, that part got better, and the sort of the chronic scarred portions stabilized. They haven't progressed. Now, one of the challenges with bone marrow transplant is that one of the places that you can get graft versus host disease is in the lung. So that's the challenge. But I do think, you know, there's emerging evidence about bone marrow transplant. I think that it won't be hopefully too long before we have even more data and can make even more definitive recommendations about timing and maybe which patients. It's going to be a while, I think, before we've got good data about, you know, biomarkers, things that predict worse outcomes. But anyway, that's sort of the spiel on bone marrow transplant as of today. Other questions?
You have any? Are you involved with the polio system and all of that?
I can try and answer it.
Okay.
So
we were at the polio doctor, and he said he kind of agreed with me that it seemed to become, you know, at a later point in his time, and it was growth, and we had a specific lady, and so it's a red flag. So we got the MRI, scarring malformation. And the neurosurgeon noticed that it's fairly small, and then he also has the record and one other thing. Then we want to figure out which one it is. Maybe that's causing it, or maybe not that's causing it, and it's just because it's hyper-IgD. It's very complicated. So
yes.
I don't know at this point, it's like, well, do we go ahead and go with any bracing until we can figure out what's causing it, or do we?
So what is the system?
Well, the,
you haven't done this, or?
No, he doesn't have symptoms. It's just you can see the curve.
And so I'll just tell you, so our experience has been that the scoliosis, and it's during rapid growth, so during the adolescent years where we see the scoliosis really change.
The pain.
Yeah, and so
You know, the challenge, so he's got three challenges.
Yeah, and those other two things, you know, the Bud Carey and the Tethered Cord are not as so he's got things that independently pretty risky problems there. So for most of our patients, the reason that we done either bracing or that ultimately they come for spinal rod placement has been because of respiratory compromise, probably the primary reason. We've not had any patients who have had neurologic deficits as a result of their scoliosis, but we have had some who have had respiratory compromise. And when you've got lungs that may already have holes in them and aren't working very well, and then you crunch down, you know, you bent in a way that it crunches down on your one normal lung, it's very hard to be able to breathe. And so those patients are the ones that we seek for spinal rod placement for. Oh, yeah, yes, it's a very good surgery. Like I told you, that is one patient that we had, you know, it was transplanted, you know, first got infected and hadn't taken that out. It was a disaster.
So there was no other
that
would make him a better candidate for bone marrow, or
it's hard to say. I don't know with regard to the scoliosis. Yeah, we don't know. I don't know whether the improvements that they've seen in I don't know whether the scoliosis can be stabilized or whether it even improved, like they saw with the osteoporosis in their one patient. I don't know. We just said there's just not enough for it. There's probably good. Good question. Yeah. The one thing I can recommend, though, is I would give more than one opinion before anybody starts having truant and stuff. Yeah, so don't be shy about getting two to three opinions before you.
We have the premier CRE guy on the case.
Perfect.
He's not wanting to do anything so he can figure out what the risk of the process is.
So that's and that's smart. Don't be shy about speaking out to physicians and the problem with that piece of it is that it's because of the low bone density that makes that surgery particularly needed.
Even have a fracture.
Mm-hmm. And not all of them have. Yeah. Other questions? Well, thanks for being here and asking questions. It's been a great discussion.
Appreciate it.
Good questions.